series of lecture on game theories and start to discuss quantization by a functional integral method, of course. That's favorite method, and that's a subject of the course. So, non-abelian gauge series. Quantization. And yes, well, last lecture we have seen how they are defined at the classical level, what is a non-abelian vector feed or vector gauge connections. And we have seen how to define in a proper way the basic subject, covariant derivative, field, the stress, the field tensor, and then the a classical action which has the desired property of gauge invariance. So today I'm going to define, to discuss what is, how you can start to try to quantize the theory by functional integration. I'm going to define, to discuss the problem of gauge fixing, which is in fact already present and you have discussed in canonical quantization of abelian gauge series, but it's more, the problem of gauge fixing is more subtle because of the non-abelian nature of the gauge symmetry. And I'm going to give the most elegant solution of this problem, which is a problem of the introducing the gauge fixing term. Well, gauge fixing term is a natural solution, but to treat it properly, we'll get to see that what is the solution, and the solution is a famous Fadeyev Popov determinant and the ghost, the famous ghost trick, which allows to construct a well-defined perturbation theory which is consistent. Okay, so first, just reminders, I've been doing mostly the case of SU2 gauge theories. So we have seen that we have a gauge, a vector field A mu, which I write as, in fact, in the compact way, as A mu A of TA, where TAs are the generator of the TA equal 1/2 sigma A, the three generators of the Lie algebra. Algebra of SU2. So that A mu lives in the adjoint representation, of the group. Okay. We have seen that, so that's a compact notation. So this means that A mu is a 2/2 graceless Hermitian matrix field. And the AMU are of course real field, because we are dealing with this. The TA form a basis of the adjoint representation, and the adjoint representation is three dimensional. It's a real three dimensional vector field. Okay. So we have seen that, in fact, the definition of a gauge transformation the following. So this is a vector field. The gauge transformation or the gauge invariance come from the fact that a gauge transformation is defined by in an elementary, an infinitesimal. I'm going to change A mu into A mu of x plus d mu alpha of x, where alpha of x is data of three gauge transformation. So we have three independent generators, three infinitesimal gauge transformation function, and d mu is the famous covariant derivative. which now depends on a mu, and d mu of alpha of x is defined as the ordinary derivative d mu alpha of x minus I a mu of x alpha of x. That's a shortened notation for writing d mu for each component alpha a. And I remember that in order to have that, you have that generator. When you compute TA, TB, this is in all IFABC of TC for the generator and for SU. So those are called the structure constant of the algebra for a general Lie group. And for SU2, FABC is just the totally anti-symmetric three tensor, the Levi-Civita tensor, or SU2. Okay, so that's an infinitesimal gauge transformation, and something I mentioned, but I will repeat it this way, that if you consider now a finite gauge transformation, is not generated by a alpha, but an element of the group, so let me call it G of X, an element of SU2. We make a global finite gauge transformation. So infinitesimal means simply that G of X is 1 plus I alpha. And for this, you can check that A mu is transformed, A mu of X is transformed of into G of X, which is a unitary matrix, times A mu of X minus I d mu of g minus 1 of x. Okay, so you see that you take the matrix, you take its inverse, and you sandwich a mu minus I d mu between the two. And the d mu acts on g, which causes the d mu alpha, but also you have to use the anti-commutation of the C. So an infinitesimal representation means simply that I'm considering that g of x is the matrix 1 plus I alpha of x plus I order term in alpha. Okay, but so g is a unitary, general unitary matrix. Okay?
Is the g of x the
Gibbs
transformation?
Pardon?
Is the g of x the gauge transformation?
That's the definition of a gauge transformation for a global. So you can write this as A mu prime of X. So this is the finite and general form of a gauge transformation when you perform a non-infinitesimal gauge transformation. Okay?
My confusion is, I guess, are the two alphas the same? The alpha there in the most general form?
I have no alpha here.
You have it when you define what a gauge transformation is on the...
Okay, no, but I mean that this definition is a general one. And if you consider that G is a unitary transformation close to the identity transformation, it reduces to this one. When you take that G of X is 1 plus I alpha of X plus higher order terms. You know that a unitary transformation, you can write it in all as exponential of I times some matrix with the right property. Okay, so infinitesimal and finite gauge transformation. That's going to be useful. Yes?
Does the gauge transformation have to be unitary?
Yeah, because a gauge transformation is transforming the field according to the symmetry group of the theory, and here the group is unitary. If you were dealing with a gauge theory with another group, like for instance an O3 group or rotation group or some more fancy Lie group, then it would not be a unitary transformation, but transformation, the matrix representation in the fundamental representation. Okay, so this is for SU2. Okay, and in fact, that's from this definition, you see the covariant derivative comes out naturally. Yes.
I fail to see why it's there is the I d mu term. Why is it not just the conjugation G A G inverse? Why do we?
Because then it's not a local gauge transformation. That's the definition of gauge transformation. And you can check that it works for Maxwell theory. For the Maxwell theory, that's exactly the same thing. But simply here, for Maxwell theory, U1 Maxwell theory, then G is a SU, well, G is a U1 one by one matrix. So you take for G of X simply exponential of I alpha of X. That's a general form of a one by one matrix, which is unitary, is just multiplication by a phase. Okay. And then A mu has just one component. So you transform A mu into E I alpha of X, A mu minus I d mu, apply to E minus I alpha of X. But here, those are just complex numbers. You don't have to pay attention to commutation relation. Okay. And you check that this E I alpha A mu E minus I alpha is just A mu. And this is I mu minus I E mu of minus I alpha of X. Is this I minus or plus? No, I think it's a minus. No, it's, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. This is a plus here. Hence the importance of right show. This is a plus. Okay. Then I get plus a d mu of minus I alpha in minus I d mu of alpha times exponential, the exponential. So you get plus. E mu alpha. Okay. So this definition encompasses the definition of a gauge transformation in the Maxwell theory. And in this way, it's very. Okay. And out of this, we have seen that we can define a field tensor which depends, I'm sorry, which depends on the. By just taking the covariant, you know, the commutator of two covariant derivatives. And we can define an action.
Also?
Yes?
Is the definition for the general gauge transformation only applicable for adjoint representation? Or
pardon?
Is that definition only applicable for adjoint representation? Or
this is a definition for an adjoint representation. I'm sorry, no. You see, A mu is a gauge field.
Yeah.
So it's not a matter field. So this explains why A mu transform with this d mu alpha term. A global gauge transformation for a field phi in the fundamental representation. Let me write it. So if phi f is a field in the fundamental representation, it's just a 2x2 vector. A two vector we have seen. Okay. Then a gauge transformation is just a symmetry. A gauge transformation is just I multiply phi f by g phi f, with g an element of the group. If phi is a field in the adjoint representation, so it's a 2x2 matrix, then a gauge transformation by an element G, if you want, is phi A goes to G phi A times G minus 1. That's the definition of a gauge transformation in the adjoint representation. And here you see that it has to be a symmetry. You have no d mu. But the effect of a gauge transformation in the connection is an A mu, which deals as in Maxwell's theory, as in order to, you know, compensate the transformation, if you perform gauge transformation, which are not global, but depends on space, time. So the definition of a symmetry transformation, symmetry gauge transformation on fields. And that's exactly like in Maxwell. In Maxwell's theory, this is a transformation multiplication by a phase when you act on, for instance, the Dirac field. And but the only difference is that in the max in the U1 theory, the adjoint representation is trivial because you have no traceless Hermitian matrix. It's just a matrix whose has to be traceless, so it's zero. So this is trivial for U1, but non-trivial for the other group. Okay, I'm going to use a bit even more shorthand notation. Well, in here you see that I denote AMU, the multiplet will contain the three AMUA, but you can define an object which is called A of X by combining all the E mu of X and adding a DX mu, where this is a one form. So if you, I define some formal DX mu here, it's called the one form. So each DX mu are different. And in this way, A mu is defined as a connection. It describes the parallel transport. Okay. And that's a compact still more compact notation, where you implicitly in this notation, it contains the Lorentz indices and the gauge field indices A. Okay. Yes?
The one form lives on which vector space?
This is a connection which lives on a bundle over the space. So you have your space-time here. M13, and around each space, you have the group. You have a copy of the group. E, so it's called the fiber bundle with fiber, and the AMU defines a parallel transport along some direction in each direction. So AMU, in fact, if you want to look at the mathematical theory, it's a mathematical theory of parallel transform and connection on fiber bundles. Okay, but I won't discuss that. I just keep this short and compact notation. But if you go in more advanced mathematical books on gauge theory, everything is well defined. Okay, so it's a connection on fiber. Okay, but that's a math language for describing gauge theory. Yes?
But it takes value in the Lie algebra. Not
yes, of course. Yes. So this is, it takes value on the Lie algebra because that's the, you know, when you have an element in a Lie group and you make a small transformation of it, you move it but a little bit, but so you move it by an element of the Lie algebra, of course. This is a connection on the Lie algebra, etc. So remember, those are by two matrices. I won't discuss the matter of that, but I'm sure you will meet that. Okay. So with this not compact notation, when I perform a gauge transformation, I should add the dx mu, okay, so that A of x is transformed into g of x, A of x plus I dx mu d over dx nu is effective acting of g minus 1 of x. And I'm going to denote this by ag of x. Ag of x is a gauge transform vector field by acting a finite g. So gauge transformation by g means I moved a of x into a index g of x, which is another vector field. Okay. So it's compact notation. Okay. I won't go further in this math definition. Okay, so now quantization. By functional quantization, if we apply the recipe by Penman and then all the successor, quantization by functional integration means that I'm going to have to define and then compute matrix element and S matrix element, etc., physical observable, out of something which is called like a big functional integral over some measure of all the a's, and I'm going to take here exponential of, and remember I had I over the action, the Young-Mill action for a, where the Young-Mill action for a is gauge invariant, and it was written, we have seen that it's written as minus 1 over 2 g squared integral over dx or x of the trace of f mu nu, where f mu nu was defined out of the a's. Okay. And this action is gauge invariant. This means that s of a of g is equal to s of a for any gauge transformation, gauge invariant. Okay, so this is a formal functional integral. Okay, and that's just a generalization of what can be done for the Maxwell field. Okay, and now we run into the problem of gauge invariance and gauge fixing, which is exactly the same problem that you have seen in canonical quantization in QFT one course for Maxwell theory.
Sorry,
yes?
Could you quickly say why we know that thing is gauge invariant?
Because f mu nu is a gauge invariant transformed as in a gauge covariant way. So you start from an f mu nu of a here. It's a function of a which involves derivative of the field and commutator of the field. Yeah. And I want to compute, I make a gauge transformation. So I want to compute what is f mu nu of AG when I make a gauge transformation. And f mu nu belongs to the covariant, to the adjoint representation. So I can check that this is just G, f mu nu times G minus 1. Remember, this is a 2x2 matrix. Each f mu element of f mu nu is a 2x2 matrix. This is a 2x2 matrix. And it transforms covariantly. Okay? And therefore, trace of f mu nu, okay, mu f mu nu transformed as trace of g f mu nu g minus 1 times g times f mu nu times g minus 1, this is 1, and since it's your trace, you can move the g minus 1 here. So this is trace of f mu nu. If you are not convinced, work by indices by indices. That's that, yeah.
So what that means is from the set of adjoint, from the set of adjoint fields.
Yes.
The connection is special. It transforms differently from
the connection is transformed differently, but that's a general. That's the definition of a parallel transport. it's there to compensate when you make a Gale transformation, the variation of the field. If you make a variation on the field like that, when you take the derivative of d mu, you have a derivative of g. So the definition of the covariant derivative, that reason is the covariant derivative is there to compensate. Okay, that's the, okay, so let me go back to this. So the action is there, and formally, d of a, this formal measure, is just a product of all the points in space-time, which has defined to be defined in a proper way, but can be done, for instance, by putting using a discrete space-time. And then you have a product over the mu, a product over the a of d a mu a of x. Okay. And you can check that, well, if you do things properly, this measure is also Gage invariant. It has to be. So that d of ag is equal to d of a. Or any g. Any g. Okay. Okay. So now what is the problem? The problem is precisely the problem of Gage invariant. The fact that the action is the same means that when you compare the action of two configurations A and AG, which are obtained by Gage transformation, there is no variation in the action. So there are flat directions. And therefore, when you apply the Feynman rules, you expand around a classical configuration, the propagator is ill-defined. And so I'm going to discuss that later, but the propagator is ill-defined for exactly the same reason that the naive propagator on Maxwell's theory, if you apply, is ill-defined. The transverse mode that you change a mu by a pure gauge, you do not change the physics, so you do not find anything. So you have to solve this problem, and the way one solves this problem is exactly the same thing that you want. You have to choose, by choosing the gauge fixing condition, and integrating in the functional integral only the A's that satisfy this gauge fixing condition. Okay. So that's the theory. In principle, it should work. And in gauge theory, like in Maxwell's theory, there are plenty of useful gauges that are used. There is the axial gauge, there is a Coulomb gauge. But since we are dealing with a theory which is relativistic invariant, I will discuss only one or two type of gauge fixing. Yes? So
can we repeat what we mean by flat directions?
It means I'm going to explain that immediately later. Okay. So I'm just discussing that I'm going to gauge fixing condition, and you can choose a Landau gauge. In fact, it's named Landau and some other people. Landau gauge, which is d mu, well, let me put the indices, d mu a of x equals 0. Note that this is not the covariant derivative. This is the ordinary derivative. Or something which is slightly different, which is due to Feynman, which is an extension of this, which is d mu a of x equals some arbitrary function zeta a of x. You choose a set of functions zeta a of x and fix the divergence of the field in each direction a to be this function. Okay.
Can you also please just repeat what you mean by What do you mean by propagator is ill-defined? I know that you.
That's exactly that in QED. If you write the first order variation of the action, remember, in Maxwell theory, you have that. You write it here. In Maxwell theory, you do that. So Maxwell, I'm still in Maxwell. F mu nu is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. Okay? So in Fourier space, this is, you take the Fourier transform on this, f mu nu of k is I k mu a nu minus k nu a mu. When you take the Fourier field. So to define a propagator, the propagator is somehow the inverse of the form acting on the field, which in Fourier space is something like, if I'm not mistaken, k mu nu equal k mu k nu minus delta mu nu a squared. So this is the quadratic term in the action for the Maxwell theory is k mu nu a mu a nu. Okay, so that's the analog of k equal minus delta for the scalar field, which is k squared. So k squared, you can invert it for any momentum which is non-zero. So that's fine. Here, you cannot invert it because any longitudinal modes where the momentum has the same polarization of the field is such that here k mu nu a nu equals zero. And it's just a reflection, it's equivalent to stating that you have the gauge invariance. Therefore, k mu nu is a quadratic form. For each choice of momenta, k mu nu has a direction which is a direction where the eigenvalue is zero. So you can invert it. Exactly the same thing. So it's going here, you just have to replace by putting some color indices AB. But that's the same phenomena. That's exactly the same phenomena that in Maxwell theory. This is not invertible.
How is it related to flat direction, like it just happens?
It's a flat direction because it means that when you explore your space of vector field configuration, if you are near a classical solution, it's an extremum of the action. So in general, when you move a bit far away, you have some well, and it changes the value of the action. If you have a potential like that, let's be in two directions. You have no flat direction. But if you have a potential which is something like that, let me try to write it. See, this is a potential in the two directions of the field. Here is a monomial of the action. If when you go in this direction, it's non-flat, but here it's flat. That's the meaning of flat direction.
What if we had I epsilon?
Pardon?
What if we had I epsilon to the k mu?
Why?
What if we had I epsilon like we did with the scalar?
I? Oh, well, here I'm, of course, there is some I epsilon if you go to the Minkowski space, etc. So, but that's just the idea. Well, but adding I epsilon is not important because it can be taken zero.
It is also for the scalar propagator at the pole.
It's exactly the same.
Yeah. So there is also issue for the scalar.
There is no issue with if you we can discuss that a bit later. But it's you know, when discussing just whether there are direction in the action, this is the action where when you make a transformation of the field, the variation of the field, the action doesn't change. It's not important to deal with causality. It's when you invert and compute the physical propagator. Okay, so let me continue a bit before the bridge, and I'll explain you the, now I'm going to explain to you how in a path integral these problems appear. These problems appear, okay, so now think about this very formal functional integral. We have a very big configuration space, big space of A configuration, field configuration. And it's better to write a little drawing. So where is my, well, it's contained in the notes, contains everywhere. So you see, I just have a two-dimensional blackboards, but you are going to get the idea. I have a big space of field configuration that I'm going to call A. A is a space of all A mu A of X configuration for all X in space-time. A 1, 2, 3, U equal 1, well, 0 to 3, if you want. Lorentz in this. So this is this big curly calligraphic A space, which is a huge infinite dimensional space of all possible gauge field configuration. Okay. But now, if you take some definite A, choose A in A. So this means a configuration of the gauge field. Okay? Out of A and choose a G, I'm going to write in the same way a big G, which is the sets of all functions G of X with G belonging to SU2. So it's a space of gauge transformation. So an element of G is, you know, the data of a specific choice of unitary gauge transformation given by a matrix G of X at each point of space, exactly how we did there, okay? So now, if I choose an A, a point in this calligraphic A, so a gauge field configuration, and a G in this calligraphic G, this space of all possible gauge transformation, I can associate A of G, the gauge field transform by the gauge field configuration. So I start from an A, I get an A of G, which is somewhere else in the space. Okay? And you can do that for all gauge fields. So you can define you see, you can define the orbit, this whole, the orbit here, the orbit, and how is it written here? I just have to change my notation, to check my notation. I have an orbit of the action of the gauge group in the space of gauge configuration, which is just the sets of all A of G for a given G. But of course, if you start from an A here or from an A prime here, if A prime and we've written at some A of G, they belong to the same orbit. So I'm going to denote this by A equivalent to A prime. So an orbit is just a set of all A which are equivalent. And of course, an orbit of G is a set of gauge field configuration. We describe the same physical classical configuration because they're equivalent by gauge transformation. Okay, but now, of course, if you choose another A here, this is, let's say, A0, A prime 0. If I choose an E1 here, which is not equivalent, I get another orbit. Okay, so and so I can decompose A into the space of orbits. In fact, this defines what mathematicians call the foliation of it, of G, of A. See?
I'm sorry, François. So the non-flat direction, the direction that we care about is up.
Of course, and this corresponds to the flat direction in the action. And this corresponds to the non-flat direction. Moving in, by changing orbits means that in general you change the action. But moving along the orbit, you don't change the action because of gauge invariance. Okay. Okay, so if you want to be mathematical picky, you can say that that the states of physical configuration the sets of physical configurations is just the set of all gauge field configuration quotiented by the action of the gauge transformation, because this is the space of orbits. Okay.
Also,
yes.
Curly G or
a pardon?
G. The A quotient G, is that a curly G? That's a
quality curly G, right? This is a curly G, calligraphic G, this G. No. Okay. This is a calligraphic, this big G.
It's the same thing as the gauge group, right?
It's a gauge group, yeah, exactly. G is a gauge group. No, it's a, in fact, it's not a gauge group. It's a, you have a gauge transformation for X of space. So it's a it's an infinite product of copies of the gauge group. If you want, if you like a bit of mathematical formulation, this calligraphic G is a space of gauge transformation. Is a gauge group G. In our case, G is SU2. To the power of space. Space-time. So it's the gauge group to the power of space-time. It's just a mathematical formal way to write the set of all G of X for all X. So it's an even if G is a finite dimensional group, the space of gauge transformation is an infinite dimensional group because you have one. If you have an infinite number of points. Yes?
So does A contain all the orbits and then physical P is a specific orbit? Or
A contains all the gauge field configuration, but it can be decomposed into orbits. And if you pick the space of orbits, which is basically the space of all configuration, and you quotient by the action of the group, then you get the space of physical configuration, which are the space of configuration, which are equivalent by gauge transformation, therefore, which correspond to the same physical system, describing the same physical states. Okay? Okay. And so the idea when you are deforming this functional integral is that how can we go from integral over the curly space of gauge free incarnation? Can we go into an integral over P, the space of orbit? Okay. And in fact, that's where gauge fixing plays a role, because gauge fixing corresponds simply to choose in each orbit.
They're just changing.
A field configuration which satisfies the gauge fixing condition. So, choosing a gauge fixing, very schematically, means choosing in each orbit a gauge field configuration which satisfies the gauge fixing condition. So, it corresponds to choose a transverse. The slicing, which is transverse to the orbit. Okay, and so what one needs to do is to integrate only on this space, this slice, gauge fixing slice, which is orthogonal to the orbit. And one has to find the proper way to do that. And that's where this.
I'm kind of confused on the whole configuration.
Yes.
On each orbit, we fix our g, and we have different a's, and we and so, what is it? Why is it just one line? What does that even mean? So you have you say I have a particular g, and then I have all my a's.
No, that's I was a bit. I started from a given g.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. No, I started from a given a,
mm-hmm.
and then. All the points in the orbit are the A prime, which can be written as A transformed by G. But if you choose another A here, you on this A
okay.
is A of G of this A, but each A of another G of this one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so all the A's on the orbit are related to each other by transformation of a given G.
Of a G, which depends on the transformation you find.
I think the definition should be changed. Like orbit of A is all
any G for a given for one orbit.
For a given A. I'm sorry. That's for a given. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I wrote the correct for a given A. I'm sorry. Given A. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
A, you want A is equivalent to A prime, so in the same orbit, if there is a G such that A prime equal A of G. So if you take another A double prime, it will be another G, etc. Okay. So it's a good time to make a short break, so a 2-minute break, and then I explain what's the result of this choice. Yes? So you are free to bet.
What is the geometric structure of the space P?
Over?
If we are integrating over P, that quotient, like I don't understand because A is not a manifold.
A is not? A, formally, A is a is an infinite dimensional space, but you can give it a metric, and therefore a measure on it. And in fact, it's a metric space. But you can do that, but it's quite formal. But you can define what is the distance between two A and A prime when they are close. And you can define a metric which is gauge invariant, and therefore, in fact, it's somehow a metric space. So you can define a measure of it, and that's the solution. This is a measure which is corresponding to this metric space, and therefore, an orbit is a submanifold, and if you choose a slice, it's an orthogonal or at least transverse to the orbit. And you can walk.
There it should be orbit of A.
Orbit of A is all AG for a given A.
Yeah. Or an orbit
of A, right?
Of A is a space of AG which are.
An orbit of G.
Yeah. For a given A.
No. In the name it's written an orbit of G, but it should be an orbit of A for a given A.
Ah, okay. Well, I think it's just. It's an orbit of the action. Yeah, you can say that. It's the orbit of A. It's the orbit of A under the action of G. Yeah.
The first question is, how can we know that just one equation is enough?
Pardon?
How can we know that just one equation is enough to
one
equation like not gauge?
One gauge fixing condition works? I'm going to discuss that later. It's not an obvious question. Okay.
Pardon? The other question is how to find the direction that is proportional to the Lewis.
You mean the direction?
Yeah. Any kinds of function can be fixed.
Well, these directions are given by gauge fixing, by gauge transformation. We know what they are. The question is how can you choose a good choice of other direction? But that's what the good gauge fixing condition works. But I'm going to discuss that just now.
Sorry, why are we supposed to fix the gauge? What happens if we don't? We just
if you don't, you get into this problem when you try to do perturbation theory. The very formally, the functional integral is always well defined. But the question is, how can you derive calculational rule out of the functional integral?
Because what I don't understand is that physically we're saying we want to integrate over all configurations of A.
Yeah.
But you add the term physical by just fixing your gauge. But why not just say I'm gonna calculate the integral over all A configurations, even if some of the A's are equivalent to each other.
Well, yes. No. You can do that, and that's actually there is. One domain of gauge theories, which is called lattice gauge theories, where people make computation in gauge theories by discretizing space-time into a lattice, and then define properly this functional integral, because now it's an integral over a finite number of degrees of freedom, and then just integrating by computer or some other techniques, but integrating over the gauge field configuration. So in doing that, you are overcounting many configurations. But on the other hand, you don't need any gauge fixing. So.
What should the integral be? So you said overcounting. Why should the integral be the summation of all the different physical configurations as opposed to all configurations, even if they're equivalent with a gauge transformation?
You can do both. If you do the gauge transformation, taking into account the effect of gauge transformation matters if you want to be sure that your calculational scheme will give a result which is physically consistent. Because gauge invariant is important, for instance, to get results which are unitary, where probability are preserved, probability are positive, unitarity is restored. So that's if you want to perform, perturbative calculation, for instance, you need to get rid of this problem of the flat direction. So you have to integrate only on some transverse direction to the flat direction, and you have to do the. So I'm going to explain this just now. Okay?
Is the flat direction, is that equivalent here to going along an orbit?
Flat directions means going along an orbit, precisely, because the action is the same for all gauge field configuration which belongs to the same orbit. So the action is the same because the action is gauge invariant. So those are the flat direction.
So why does going along an orbit mean that the propagator is not invertible?
Because the variation of the action is zero to all orders. Therefore, when you compute a propagator, you make a variation and you compute the Hessian of it, the second derivative, and you invert the second derivative matrix. But if the second derivative matrix has zero modes, you cannot invert it. That's just it. Okay, so, yes?
Why are the orbits should be like parallel to each other? Why
Well, here they are not really parallel. It's just a drawing. They just cannot cross. You see, because if you, okay, if you have an orbit and another one which cross, it means that there is a gauge transformation where this point is sent to this one and another gauge transformation where this point is transformed to this one. Therefore, there is a gauge transformation which sends this one to this one. So if two orbits cannot cross by definition.
You only essentially have one A that's physical.
The orbit as defined says that. Well, one A depends on the gauge fixing. Okay.
So like if it crossed, then you could map it all to one A.
If it crossed, it means simply that the orbit is something like that, some bigger space where you can find a gauge transformation which sends this point to this point.
But then you could find for all A's on both of those lines, you could map them to each other, right?
No, you can always, because here you have a gauge transformation, here you have another gauge transformation. Gauge transformation form a group, so you can combine them. You make a gauge transformation here, times a gauge transformation here, and you get another gauge transformation that maps this to this. Remember, it's because it's a group.
Oh, okay.
Okay, you'll see more clear. Okay. So this is the principle. So now, the idea is, So now I'm going to discuss what is this. So we have to define, the idea is how to integrate over orbits, and each choice of orbit depends on the gauge fixing condition. Okay, choosing a transverse slice is equivalent to choose the gauge fixing condition. And of course, if you choose some different gauge fixing condition, well, you are going to have possibly a different slice. So this is gauge fixing one, and this is gauge fixing two. And you have to define an integration rule so that integrating with this over this transverse slice with the gauge fixing one, or integrating over this transverse slice with gauge fixing two, gives the same results for the physical quantity one computes. Okay, so formally. Let me write my gauge fixing condition F. I choose, for instance, a Landau gauge. And the Landau gauge means that you choose a set of gauge fixing condition at any point, FA of X. And that's a functional of here. This is d mu a mu a of x to be equal to zero. So you have a set of gauge fixing condition, and you have three gauge fixing condition to each point. Okay. So I'm going to write this in a formal way, compact way, as I did by writing that the sets. So this is F of A is just the data of all d mu a mu a of x for all a and all x. Okay. I denote this F of A. This is gauge fixing F for fixing condition for the field A. So it's a collection of functions, of gauge fixing function for each a and at each point. But you see that it involves derivative of A. So this gauge fixing f of a, you know, so naively, making a gauge fixing amounts to change my functional integral g of a times x.
What is a1x there?
Pardon? A is a gauge fixing, you know. For each a of mu, for each a mu a of x, you can compute this. And of course, so you get a set of function which to any a associate f of a at a point x and coordinate a. So it's a functional of the field a. It's a functional of the a mu a of x. Of the gauge field configuration, because for each a mu a of x, you get another function which is d mu a mu a of x. It's a functional, a function which sets a function, the a mu a, into another function.
Okay. Yeah.
Functional. It sends f mu a into some f a of x. Which is by definition d mu a of x. Okay. It sets for a function a mu a of x, you get the function a of x for each. Okay. So it's a functional of the gauge fixing functional. Okay. So the idea is, can we replace this by with the exponential of the action? Can we write it as integral dA with a gauge fixing condition? And the gauge fixing condition is that FA is equal to zero. So can I write this as a functional Dirac delta function for each F of A? Okay, can I write this like that? Where delta of f of v means, in fact, f of a, that's a very compact way to write the products of all points in space-time, products of all a, 1, 2, 3, of the gauge fixing condition, delta of f a of x, which is, of course, products over x, products over a, a Dirac delta function of d mu f mu a, I'm sorry, a mu a of x. Okay, so that's a compact way to write the Dirac delta function in the space of functions as a product of ordinary Dirac delta function. Okay. Dirac delta function. Okay. Well, so is this working? In this very formal way, this cannot work for a simple reason. You have to add something. Something is missing. Because basically, the idea comes out from the fact that, you know, imagine that you want to integrate a function. I give a very simple example. Imagine that I have a function, some function f of a variable x. It's another variable. It's just a variable x on the real line. Okay, and I have some function f of x. Yeah. And imagine that there is one point where f of x of 0 equals 0. You see, at x of 0, f of x is equal to 0. And how can I write delta of x minus x of 0? This is this little x minus x of 0. How can I write a Dirac delta function at the point where f of x of 0 is equal to 0? Well, you could say, oh, say, may I replace this by the function delta of f of x0? Because the function, the Dirac delta function of f of x0 has support exactly at the point where x0, I'm sorry, f of x, takes this measure. Dirac delta function of f of x. This measure has support at x0. So it might be proportional to the Dirac delta function at x0. But in fact, it is not. Because it depends on the slope. And in fact, the difference is the derivative of f prime of x at x0. Simply for the same reason that if you compute the Dirac delta function of 2x, this is 2 times the Dirac delta function of x. So if I want to write a constraint that x is located at x0 by a delta function, if I replace this by the Dirac function of the constraint which fixes x0, I have to add something.
Is that supposed to be 1 over f prime?
No. No, because check,
delta
you know.
X is 1 over 2 delta x.
No. Delta of 2x is 2 delta of x. I'm sorry, that's better. No, you are right. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I've wrote it in the wrong way. Delta of x is 2 times delta of 2x. Yes, so delta of x is the derivative with the sign times with the absolute value times delta of x. Yeah, because it's this one. Yes, I'm sorry. And you can check because if you apply this to a test function, you make the change variable x to 2x, and this is the change in the measure.
Yeah.
So this is a general formula. Okay, so there is something which is missing here, and this is the analog. This is the analog of this term, the absolute value of the derivative of the f of x. Okay. And, so there is something, and this is going to be something that I'm going to define. I give the solution. This is the absolute value of a determinant of a matrix, of an operator, which is basically the analog of the derivative of the function of A in the Dirac delta function. So it's a determinant of an object. And now I'm going to show you what is this object and how this makes sense. But this determinant is called Fadiyev Popov determinant. Right. In fact, Feynman and Rice-DeWitt also shown that this determinant must be.
On the other side of, so like going back to our kind of analog, we had the delta of f of x times absolute value, you know, the
yes.
And we had the delta of x on the other side, but in this integral, we don't have like a delta of a. Do we need a delta of a on the left hand side? On the left hand side of the equation, do we need
Yeah, so in fact, this is equivalent, well, up to some factor. What I'm going to show is that this is somehow equivalent to this, up to some constant.
How come it's not equivalent? Like, if we have a delta on the right-hand side, shouldn't we have a...
You are right. I wanted to skip this because I wanted to go fast, to go a bit faster and explain later. But basically, the point is that the idea is that, okay, I choose a gauge fixing condition that I'm going to write in a very compact way, f of a equals 0.
Okay.
For each a, for each orbit of a, there is some A of the orbit. Let's A0 such that F of A0 equals 0. And therefore, I want to replace this by an integral over dA, but then where I have an integral of the orbits, and I have a delta of A minus A0, where the A0 depends on the orbit. So I want to pick a point in each orbit and integrate only on this orbit. That's the idea. But
then how come we don't have that extra integral on the right hand side?
Pardon?
How come we don't have the extra integral over the orbits on
there? Is going to be an integral over the orbit, but integrating over the orbits will amount to integrate over the gauge field. So let me continue and explain what this strange formula means before going into deriving briefly how it goes. So pardon? Of course. Otherwise, I will have cheated you. Okay. So, in order to define what is f prime? What is this f prime of A? Let's consider just the following question: how does the gauge fixing term, the gauge fixing condition, FA equal d mu A mu A of X, okay, which is, in fact, it's a functional of the gauge field A at the point X. See, for each A, you associate an FA of X, which is given by this d mu A. I'm here dealing with numbers. How does the gauge fixing term changes when I perform the gauge transformation? It should change because the gauge fixed term is just there to fix, to get rid of the gauge transformation. So let me assume that I perform a gauge transformation. So I just going to perform an infinitesimal gauge transformation. So I choose a g of x, which is 1 plus I alpha of x plus, yeah, under this gauge transformation, some general A mu A of x, A mu A, changes into A mu of x plus the variation, delta A mu of x. And delta A mu of x has been defined here. Delta A mu of x is just the covariant derivative of alpha of x plus higher order terms. And remember, this is a matrix, and that's a covariant derivative of a matrix, which is defined by the ordinary derivative minus I, the commutator, equal mu of x plus d mu alpha of x plus or minus, I never remember, minus I, the commutator of mu of x is alpha of x. Okay, so this is the variation. Okay. So now, how d mu of a mu of x changes here? this A F of A, A of X, which is D mu mu A of X, changes obviously as, well, the D mu of A mu plus the variation. So it changes as D mu A of X plus something which is the, well, it's a D mu is index up, D mu upstairs of D mu alpha of X plus higher order terms. So this is the variation we are interested here. Okay, which can be rewritten as E mu A mu A of X plus D mu of alpha of X, that's the ordinary derivative, minus I D mu is an index, this is D, D, D mu, that's the derivative with respect of the commutator of A mu of X with alpha of X. But that's D mu of this commutator. Okay, so this is the variation. Okay. So the variation, this object is what we could call the variation delta. This is the variation of FA A of X when I perform a Gauss transformation with this infinitesimal alpha of X. So the variation is this term, and if you work a bit more, you have to apply the d mu to these products of two matrices that depend on alpha of X. This d mu alpha of X is, can be written as d mu alpha of X. So that's the ordinary Laplacian operator associated, applied to the Gauss transformation, minus I d mu of A mu of X combined with alpha of X. And another term, which is minus I mu of X combined with d mu alpha of X. Okay. So you see that you can view this as some operator apply to the field alpha at time x, because it involves a term which is, you know, multiplying alpha of x by some matrix. But you take the commutator. You have a term which contains two derivatives applied to alpha of x.
Sorry, how come the index on the derivative, when applied to alpha, goes downstairs instead of upstairs?
I'm sorry, this is d mu. Yes, the index is upstairs. Yes, yeah. All right. I have a tendency to do not pay attention. Okay, so this is an operator, but it's a differential operator apply to the alpha of X.
I fail to see how that could be the case where the variation in F is equal to an operator times alpha, because the operator will always act to the right. But in the commutator, we have an alpha of X that is to the left of the gauge field.
No, because here, I'm sorry, I think I'm right. D mu acts to the right. So here, D mu acts on this whole object. So if you want to write, this is d mu of a mu of x times alpha of x, products of two matrices, minus alpha of x of, times a mu of x.
But we.
But here, this is, I'm sorry. Here, this is d mu of a mu applied to a mu commutator with alpha of x. And here, this is the commutator of a mu of x times d mu applied on alpha of x. Now, this is a matrix. And this is a matrix. Well, here I had an operator.
What I don't understand is in the commutator, there is a term that goes alpha of x times d mu of a mu of x, where alpha of x to the left. Because it's in the commutator. The second term of the commutator comes with a of x first and then a mu of x.
I'm not sure I understand your question. No, I'm saying, because you see, I apply d mu to this matrix, which is a product of the commutator of two matrix which depend on x. So I have to use a definition of a derivative of two functions. It is the derivative of first function times the second function plus the first function times the derivative of the second function, keeping care of the order because those are matrices, so they do not commute. And the commutator is not zero.
I think what Dawid is asking.
Pardon?
I think what Dawid is asking is if we expand out the commutator, you're going to have some situations where alpha is over here and a is over here, which is weird because the operator. With the operator, alpha is always on the right.
I think there is no problem. And if you are in an node like this, just write it in terms of a matrix of decompose in terms of the in the basis of the Lie algebra. You see, write that a mu of x is a mu a of x a times t a, where the t a are generators which do not depend on x. Write alpha of x as alpha a of x times t a. And then a mu alpha commutator is just a mu alpha a t a, and this is a mu a alpha b times I epsilon, well, the structure constant epsilon a b c times t c. Okay, and here now these are functions of x. Okay. And therefore, when I compute d mu of a mu alpha, a mu of x alpha of x, this is just computing d mu, the derivative with respect to x of a mu a of x times alpha b of x. And here, this is the term which depends on x. And I epsilon a b c t c are just these are matrices, these are numbers, and they do then. And here you are safe. D mu a mu a of x times, well, d mu applied to this function times alpha b of x plus a mu a of x times d mu applied to alpha b of x. So this is a function. This is a function. And then you can rewrite it in terms of matrices and you get this result. There is no problem. Here, d mu is applied to this matrix. So it doesn't act on this one. And here it acts on this one and it doesn't act on this one. I'm taking a derivative of products of matrices, of products of matrices. And this is the composition of the derivative on each matrices is a product taken. Okay, so you see that this is a differential operator. And if you think in term of if you think in term of of a component, and if you work a little bit, that's what I wrote, that's it's written in my note. This operator is just what I'm calling the operator f prime of A. So formally, let me write it here. So this is a specific definition. So basically, what I'm calling the operator f prime of A is just the functional derivative of the f of A taken at a point x. When I take variation at a point y, you see? So the matrix element of xy of this operator, which is a functional derivative of a functional by another function, formally, this is defined by this matrix element as the first operator, d mu d nu, that's just a scalar application. And I can then I can replace this by minus I times. So when I apply this to a function, which is here delta alpha, so that's you know, I apply it to a function. This is d mu d nu minus I, the commutator of d mu mu with a function I'm applying to, minus I times mu times the operator d mu acting on the function here. Okay. And I'm considering the xy matrix element of this differential operator. And if you, it's better to write it in terms of component A mu A and alpha A, if you want to be sure. Then you find that this f prime of A. Yes.
You have a mixture of mu's and nu's in the first.
Pardon.
Have mu and nu in the first term, but then later you have.
I'm sorry, that's a typo of mine. Mu, a mu. Okay, so if you want to write it in terms of component of a b component, because that's an operator that acts on in the Lie algebra. So this f prime of a, let me call it g. It's written g in my note. So formally, g is just d mu. D mu d mu, very formally, but it means that the matrix element G A B it's acts in the Lie algebra, so you decompose it into a matrix element, and G A B is just a composition of a differential operator, so it's delta A B times the Laplacian, with the ordinary Laplacian is just d mu d mu. And then you get epsilon ABC with the structure constant of the SU2 group times A mu B. And then you have, and then you have d mu, but acting on the left. On the right, and then you have the results of what happens when you have d mu, which is applied on a mu, and then you get d mu a mu b. That's a function. And then you have no derivative operator, but you have epsilon a b. This must be a c. Epsilon a b c. Okay. So this is the explicit value for this operator. You see, it's an operator that acts on functions which are vector in the space. So it means that g mu applied to a function. A set of element function psi b. You first take delta ab times the Laplacian applied to the function.
Also, the superscript should be c, I think.
There is a c here. Oh, yes, you are right. That's a typo in my notes. Yes. Yeah. And then I'm not sure of the sign, but you are right. That's formula 6.5.50. Empty in the notes, but you are right, there is a typo between the A and B indices. I'm very sorry. So I'll check the indices. The A, B, C indices, and there are possibly some signs which are the opposite. But basically, this is now a differential operator acting on functions in the Lie algebra operator. These are the alpha of x, and it's a combination of a second order derivative operator, which is just a Skandar Laplacian, a first order multiplied by a function, and then multiplication by a function. So this is second order, this is first order, and this is zero order with indices, and it depends on AMU. So this is the differential operator that I'm calling G, or D mu, D nu, or F prime of A, a different notation used in the lecture for the same object. And basically, the formula is that I have to take in the functional integral, I have to add to the delta Dirac gate fixing condition the absolute value of the determinant of this functional, of this differential operator. Which depends on the gauge field A. See? And you were one or two of you among you were worried about where does the volume of the orbit term comes from. In fact, the exact formula is that if you want to integrate over all gauge field configurations, so I have a formal big configuration. This is written by integral of a dA. You have this delta, Dirac delta function formally, compact way to write that I'm informing by a delta function all the gauge field configuration. And then I have the determinant, the absolute value of the determinant of the differential operator, which is f prime of A. This differential operator, so this is a functional determinant of, and then, well, somewhere I'm missing the integration of the orbit, but the integration with the orbit, if you work properly, is just the integration over the gauge transformation with a measure on the gauge group. So this is just the volume of the gauge group to the power the number of points. So, for space. So you have here the volume of the orbit, the rule, space, calligraphic G of a gauge transformation, which is of course independent of the gauge configuration. I have separated in a proper way the integration over the orbit as an integration over all possible gauge transformation times this. Okay? And the price to pay for this is that I have this pi df Popov functional determinant of a differential operator which depends on A. So you see that this is the explicit form of the differential operator. It depends on the gauge field configuration. Okay. So, and that's the general recipe. And in fact, this is the explicit form I've wrote for the Landau gauge, but this can be generalized to, in fact, any gauge field fixing condition, gauge invariance fixing condition. Okay. So it depends on A and on F, of course, on F gauge fixing choice. But with this procedure, I know that an integral which doesn't depend on the gauge fixing choice is transformed into an integral where you have two independent terms which depends on the gauge fixing choice. But I know that the resulting result measure will give something which is gauge invariant, not going to depend on the gauge fixing choice. Okay.
Over there, when you say the volume, it's the volume of the group, the gauge group.
It's a volume of the whole space of gauge transformation. So in some.
That's the volume. So the integral over the d of g. That's not the natural volume form on the gauge group, is it?
It's formally the integral over all gauge configuration. So you see, integral over G of G is G, is just the product of all points in space-time of the integral over the gauge group, which is now a finite dimensional group, with a measure dG, and of course, well, I've cheated a bit. This is going to be, you have to take in a consistent way, the R measure on G, which is the only measure. There is a mass theorem which says that you take a compact reducible D group, like, for instance, SU2, there is a unique measure on the group which is invariant under the action of the group on itself.
My problem is the way we defined the measure for the path integral.
Yes.
It contains an H bar inside of it.
Pardon?
It contains an H bar inside of it because we defined it through. Lattice regularization and then taking the continuum limit. That's equivalent to this R measure that is the natural volume form.
The measure doesn't depend on H bar. Well, here I wrote that the term of the action was exponential of I over 2g squared integral, well, the action S of E. Of course, so I set h bar equal 1. If you are going to have to set h bar not equal to 1, you have to pay h bar here. You have to pay attention to the factor of h bar, but that's when it's defined properly, there is no problem. It will just give some h bar factor which is going to factorized out. So at that level of the discussion, you can assume that you have normalized everything so that h bar equal 1. Otherwise, you can reabsorb it into the definition of the coupling constant and the what you call the how you normalize the fields that you integrate over.
You're not so having a quantizing the measure, right?
Pardon?
You're not quantizing the measure. Like, you could write this measure as it is without any quantization procedure to measure the A. I don't see where is the quantization.
Well, this is a formula for the measure. And you have to apply to apply this measure to this, for instance, this exponential term.
So the
but since it's gauge invariant, you don't care.
But, like, I mean, we can use this measure in any special relativity theory that is not quantized as well.
No, because this is... This is the measure which defines the functional integral, which leads to the construction of a quantized gauge theory, of a quantum theory. I'm not sure I understand your remark.
I mean, like, the measure is classical. The quantum part is it sits in the Hubble, like the action, like the H4 that you wrote there for.
All of this is just a proper way to define what I mean by the measure over the field configurations which has to be used in the path integral, the functional integral. Quantization means integrating with this measure or with this measure object like that. So first the exponential of the action so that we quantize properly the theory with its proper action. So this defines the dynamics. The quantum theory, and in addition, you can add the physical observable to compute vacuum expectation value of operator. You can add time sub observable of the gauge field A. They have to be gauge invariant, and that's there exists gauge invariant observable. For instance. Well, the energy trace of F mu nu is gauge invariant. So you can compute, at least in theory, what is the expectation value of this in a gauge theory by just inserting, computing with this passing, with this measure, this action, and inserting this in the path integral.